Hi, welcome to episode 24 of Forensic Forecast. That's right, Kiefer Sutherland has got nothing on us.
Yeah.
You sound excited as always, Simon.
I just thought that was a bit of an odd thing to say.
All right, fine. If I can bring in a little bit of, entertainment, I guess. Lack of a better word. But obviously, it doesn't work. Not for you, anyway.
Nah, I'm not particularly easy to impress, as listeners may have noticed.
Yes, and if they haven't noticed, then they should meet you in the flesh and see exactly how unimpressed you are with things.
What, do you think I can sound more impressed than I actually am when you see me in person?
No, I think people will be impressed with your lack of being impressed. I'm going to confuse myself now. Let's just get on with things.
Yeah,
let's move on. How have you been the last couple of weeks? Done anything fun and interesting?
What have I done? Well, we've agreed to pay out a substantial amount of money to a builder to come and do some work on the house.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So that's fun. We get the house actually a bit warmer and things, so it's always a good thing.
Well, especially with how freezing cold it gets in England. I would say in winter, but it's pretty much all year round these days.
Yeah, just winter, spring, summer. It's generally pretty cold and pretty wet.
Yeah.
So
next week is the F3 conference here in England. Pretty much everybody who's anything to do with digital forensics over here knows about this conference. And a lot of people are attending. And I'm going to be attending for the first time. Yay! Simon isn't, because he's not cool. Not as cool as me.
I'm looking after the place we work at. In the absence of everyone else, pretty much, he's going to F3.
Yeah. So I'm going to F3, and in the meantime, Simon's going to be in charge of a somewhat productive office.
Yeah.
Because I won't be there. But yeah, it's it should be lots of fun. Someone's offered to loan me a little digital recorder, so hopefully I'm going to get some interesting little tidbits here and there, and cool. We'll incorporate them into the next episode of Forensic Forecast, I think. So that should be fun. But yeah, so I'll keep you updated on how things are going on Twitter and stuff. Anyway, speaking of which, I've now made my personal Twitter account private. That's Schizofreud as the username. And if anybody wants to follow what's going on with Forensic Forecast, as in when we're recording, when new episodes are up, when new articles go on the blog, so on and so forth, you can follow at Forecast instead. And that should give you all the information you want. So if you want to follow me still, you can try and... I'm being a bit picky about who follows me at the moment. Just I'm trying to keep the spam down and so on and so forth. I'm getting lots of weird tweets lately. So, but anyway.
Yeah, people are free to follow me as well, but I've probably tweeted once in the past week.
And yeah.
That's quite a lot for me recently.
And you're not as exciting as me.
Yeah, I suppose.
Mm.
Actually, I do have quite a boring life, to be fair. I go to work, I do forensic examinations, come home and pretty much just sit and watch TV and that, yeah. Yeah, you just made me realise how boring my life is a lot of the time.
That's what I'm here for, to uplift and inspire you. Microsoft has started handing out coffee. That's COFEE. Sorry to all you caffeine addicts. But the little press release says, today at the Digital Crimes Consortium, Microsoft Corp and the National White Collar Crime Centre, NW3C, the nation's premier provider of economic and high-tech crime training to law enforcement agencies, announced an agreement establishing NW3C as the first US-based distributor, or distributor, whichever country you're from, of the Computer Online Forensic Evidence Extractor. But the thing that I think is the concerning thing about this is the little bit at the end of this story. This is on securityactive.co.uk. Law enforcement agencies with less, sorry, law enforcement agents with less than 10 minutes training can capture live evidence of illegal activity by inserting the coffee USB device into a computer. The evidence is then preserved for analysis, protecting it from being destroyed when the computer is turned off for moving. Now, I'm not saying anything against policemen, and I had similar concerns with Encase Portable, but giving someone 10 minutes training and sending them out onto a volatile computer to acquire the volatile data when they probably aren't very qualified to do it in the first place, I think you're asking for trouble.
It's a dangerous thing to do, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't take much on a live system to destroy something that could be used as important evidence.
Yeah.
It's a risk, I suppose, but I guess you've got to hope that anyone who gets one of these is put through the mill of how to use it, is given the opportunity to test it or whatever before they use it in the field, and is make sure they're confident in how to use it.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there are people, like in the States, for example, this does happen quite a lot in the States, where the local guys, the local police officers, they'll do the regular police beat work, but then they'll also do some computer forensics, like, you know, Ken Pryor and people such as him will do stuff like that. Now, over here, we don't really get that at all. People specialise in specific fields, and they don't deviate from that field at any given time. Like, they rotate through different areas, I guess. But if you're asked to do computer forensics or computer investigations or whatever, you will be doing that hardcore for, I think it's 5 years, isn't it?
Something like that.
And then you'll be moved on to something else.
Yeah, I think things are starting to change a little bit in that regard in a lot of high-tech crime units here. They're moving more towards employing people outside of police to work on these things and to be trained, and they're essentially there for life. But you do still get a number of people from police forces essentially going and doing it for just a small number of years and then going off and doing something else again.
Yeah. But, I mean, my point still is that over here, you know, if people who do the computer forensics typically aren't the people who go to the houses to seize the equipment.
No, they're absolutely
just
not.
They're just the regular policemen,
yeah,
or police women.
The most help that they'll generally get is you'll just have one of the more police officers seizing things, and they might speak to someone at the high-tech crime unit on the phone while they're there.
No, well, yeah, absolutely. So, but giving these local everyday bobbies these sticks and saying, here, when you come to a computer, just plug this in and do this, that and the other, it does concern me a little.
Yeah, considering we have spoken to people, oh, fair enough, people who have worked in the police for a good number of years who aren't particularly computer literate at all, and the majority of people in that situation are the first to admit it and first to say that they barely know how to turn a computer on in some cases, let alone how to find a USB port or something like that. So it could be interesting, depending on how it's used by police officers.
Yeah. So I'm hoping that the people receive more than just a 10-minute little training on how to use this, or they give it to somebody who's properly qualified to do it instead.
Yeah, I guess what you'd need is what's probably a good idea is to have a set of people within pretty much every police force who are trained to deal with first response stuff, and they're the ones who are called out when these things are necessary. But I guess they'd be overstretched so much that they wouldn't necessarily be able to cope.
Yep. Well, we'll wait and see how that develops, as always, and we'll see if there's any horror stories comes from that. But I think it should be all right. It just that one phrase just worried me. ever so slightly. But all right. So, speaking of coffee, somebody, believe it or not, some trustworthy folk has leaked, or rather spilled, coffee all over the internet, haven't they, Simon?
I don't know. How are we responsible? Why could it make such a mess?
This thing has managed to get onto all kinds of torrent sites and, you know, where I can't say where you can find it because that'd be a bit unethical. But it's not difficult to find it, is it, Simon?
No. However, given the amount of things that you can find around coffee as in the drink on the internet, you may inadvertently download a picture of a coffee bean or something. But in any sense, it is out there and it is possible to find it and download it by the looks of things.
Yeah. Something funny that I saw... Sorry, I'm still recovering a little bit here. Something funny that I saw on the Digital Detective Forum today was that somebody had gone on there and said, oh, coffee's been leaked, it's on the internet, blah, 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 blah. And then the next person who posted said, well, I've got a copy of coffee. If anybody would like a copy of it, give me a shout.
Here's my work email address.
Yeah. Now, this board is only for forensic investigators, for digital forensic investigators. Most of the people on there are law enforcement. I mean, the person who did this was from law enforcement.
Well, you've got to think that's kind of pointless if most of the people on the forum are law enforcement anyway, because they can get hold of it anyway.
Yeah, I know, but apparently, up until recently, it's been quite difficult for some of them to do that for whatever reason. Mm. A lot of them hadn't even really seen the software in action. But from what we understand, Simon, what is coffee actually... What does it actually do? What's it like?
It's software released by Microsoft, obviously, that is able to be used to essentially deal with a couple of fairly mundane first responding things. If you get to a scene and the computer's on, this will run a series of automated, essentially command line based tools, but in a kind of customizable fashion that you can put into a nice report layout and things. And it will run these things so that you can have a report generated at the end that will give you various bits of information. My guess is it would include stuff about user profiles, networking, running processes, things like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, Rob Lee described it, I can't remember his exact words, pretty much as a glorified Windows forensic tool chest. I think he's right.
It doesn't sound like, from what I've heard and from the screenshots that I've seen in articles online and things, it seems to me like it's a series of things that are already there, already available to be done, but it just brings things together into an easy to use format, into a software you can put on a USB drive and effectively auto-run from that drive, leaving a very small footprint on the machine. Yeah. So I can see the benefits of it, but my understanding is it's not going to give you all that much information, and there are other first responding tools out there that will give you a heck of a lot more.
Yeah, very much agreed. Now, the thing is, for me, is that if Microsoft were going to release something, and then we're going to say this is for forensic practitioners to plug into a computer, for first responders to get critical data off there, that they would give you a basic way of getting past, say, a password-protected screensaver or a Windows login screen. But it doesn't.
No, not as far as I can tell.
So, you know, if Microsoft can't provide something like that, if they've only...
Who can?
Yeah, I mean, I don't get it, but I'm sure... I mean, we know there's other ways to do that, isn't there? I mean, you mentioned when we were talking about this previously about there's the FireWire exploit you can use to do that, but you run the risk of changing data on the machine if you do.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you've got to change data on the machine regardless of what you do. If you plug in the USB stick, you are making changes regardless of, you know, whatever precautions you take, because that's just the nature of the beast, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Microsoft keeps very good logs and very good records of USB devices connected to a machine. So unfortunately, you are going to add to I forget the name of the log file, but there is a log file specifically, setup API maybe, that will record all sorts of bits of information for the drive you just plugged in and various things in the registry. So you will create those things regardless.
Yeah, oh, exactly. So, no, I just don't understand why they couldn't sort something like that out, to be honest. It seems like almost a trivial thing, and if anybody has the knowledge, it's the people who made the operating system to start with.
Yeah, you've got to bear in mind that Microsoft's a very large organization. There's a lot of people who build their own little pieces of things that are finally joined together. And so finding back doors to things and all that kind of stuff could be quite a task for any one part of an operating system. But I'd imagine it's the whole coffee thing is a work in progress, and they're planning on building onto it in the next couple of years and providing means of doing extra things that possibly other tools won't be able to do.
Yep. And then there's the second point as well about all this, is that why did it have to be leaked? Why did it have to be distributed illegally?
By law enforcement, essentially. Well, it can't have been by anyone else.
All right. Well, yeah, go on. Right. It didn't have to be, though, did it? Because it didn't have to be an LE-only product, because there's nothing on there
that you can't already do.
That isn't already just a standard stuff. From what I can, what I understand is that it just runs mostly just a bunch of command line utilities which are already built into Windows, and with a few switches and whatnot, and they just present that information in a handy little report.
Yeah. You got to think with a bit of creative batch scripting, you could easily produce the same results.
Absolutely.
And save them to a USB drive.
Yeah. And then there's the third point to all this as well, and you kind of just touched on that ever so slightly, is, first of all, someone from law enforcement has leaked this. At least one person from law enforcement has leaked this. But then, if you've got a copy of this, you can't possibly use it if you've got hold of it...
No, not legitimately, no.
Illegitimately, yeah, if you've got hold of it illegally. So what's the point in having it in the first place? Because it's just the whole thing's just a bit of an oxymoron.
Yeah, I think it's still in its early stages. I think that's possibly most of the reason why it's still free, and it's still free only to law enforcement and only available to them, because it's possibly really a kind of beta product, and maybe they're planning on doing some work before making it commercially available or something.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough, but if they do that, they're going to have to come up with something better, because there are, like you said, there are better products out there. I mean, you just look at the Windows Forensic Tool Chest that was on Helix, for example, and you know how good that is. And
yeah, the Helix tools for live response were very good and very useful.
And Coffee just doesn't appear to come close to that at all.
No, and of course, we're familiar with other tools like DriveProfit as well that can work very well and retrieve all sorts of other bits of information. Might leave a bit more of a footprint, I suppose.
Well, it's slightly different tool, though, isn't it, DriveProfit?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's basically, that gives you a platform from which to investigate. And it may report, there may be somewhat of a crossover between the stuff which DriveProfit and Coffee reports, but they kind of go in different directions, I think.
Yeah, well, the whole point of things like Coffee are to retrieve essentially live data that you might not necessarily get from investigating a quote-unquote dead machine. It could, the information you get through things like running processes and stuff, it could be useful. It could help you determine whether there's viruses, whether there's various things on the machine that hide in memory and don't really, aren't really obvious when you're just examining a hard drive.
Yeah.
So that's the purpose of these things, but I can't see anyone using it as a way of determining whether they should or should not seize anything or what they should do.
Yeah.
It's just basically to get a bit more information.
Absolutely. Okay, well, moving on. Recently has been revealed the Evil Maid attack. Now, do you want to tell us a little bit about this, Simon?
Yeah, this is quite interesting. Someone's found a way to essentially circumvent, well, not circumvent, but find a way into people's machines when they use Holder's encryption, more specifically with TrueCrypt. And this is a means of obtaining a password without the user ever possibly even having known that someone's obtained it. But it has to be a preemptive thing. Essentially what it is it's code that you load onto a USB stick. You then plug this into a computer, which you know to have full disk encryption on, and you essentially load into it a program that will load itself into memory when the computer starts, and it will save the password that's used in TrueCrypt into an inaccessible area of the disk for retrieval later for the person who brings back this USB stick later. So it's kind of an interesting little idea, but as I said, it's one of these things that you have to know about before you get to a scene, otherwise you're not really going to get much benefit out of it.
Yeah. I mean, this is an exploit for sure, because like you said, I mean, this hides a little bit of code in the first 63 sectors of the hard drive, the bit which isn't typically used. No, so when people type in their password, it's like a little keylogger hooks that and just stores the password. So let's just run through what you'd have to do in order to get a password off a TrueCrypt encrypted hard drive, okay? So first of all, you'd have to know that somebody was using TrueCrypt, okay, which isn't necessarily going to be easy to do in the first place. Then you would have to get direct physical access to that computer without anyone else's knowledge. You would then, assuming that you can actually change any settings in order to boot from USB, you'd have to do that. Then once you booted to the USB, you got to run the program and, you know, load it into that 63 sectors. Then turn off the computer and leave. Then the person's got to come back, re-enter their password to get into the computer, leave their computer alone again. You got to go back to it, boot from the USB stick again in order to retrieve the password.
I guess it's assuming that if you've already got the password stored on it, you could just pick up and grab the laptop second time and leg it out of there, really.
That's not a bad idea, actually, is it? I didn't even consider that. Yeah. No, so but
The word's gone straight out of my head. The technical bit, I suppose. You do that once, and then you can deal with the second bit a lot easier, I suppose. But
then how do you know they've entered the password if you just pick it up and run away with it?
That's a good point, actually. I don't know, but there could be circumstances where this proves useful.
Yeah.
And I guess you just, you never know. It's possibly one of these things, if you're in a surveillance type of situation or something like that, it's probably worth a try.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I mean, if you've got like a wiretap warrant or something like that on somebody, then you could run something like that perfectly. Now, this doesn't apply to computers that are using an onboard TPM. I can't remember what it stands for. But yeah, it doesn't work for those because that all the keys and the encryption, everything is handled by that module. But computers that are just running everyday versions of TrueCrypt with the full disk encryption are open to attack. Now, there are ways to avoid doing this, and it just depends on how vigilant you want to be in protecting yourself. If you're really anal, for lack of a better word, then you could change the password every single time you log onto your computer, which you can do from the TrueCrypt control panel. And, you know, stuff like that. But no one's going to do that. This is the thing. This is one of my issues with encryption, is that people encrypt something and then they'll be like, right, that's it, it's safe now, no problems. But they don't realise that, you know, encryption is just one layer of security. And unless you're sensible about what you're doing, it doesn't mean anything, as we can see from this. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's all fun stuff anyway. And speaking of fun things, I'm doing good with the segues today, don't you think? Speaking of fun and interesting things you can do with Windows operating systems, I guess that wasn't really a segue at all, was it?
Never mind, carry on.
All right. Also, in the news, this last couple of weeks, Windows 7 has been released, and it offers some interesting things. I think most people agree that it hasn't changed a great deal forensics-wise from Windows Vista, so we should be able to cope with it quite easily. One thing which is quite important, which could make forensic investigators' lives a little bit more difficult, is that when you're using Windows 7 with solid-state drives, is that whenever you delete a file, a signal is sent from the operating system to the firmware of the disk saying that this is free space and to wipe it, to zero it out. So when you delete something in Windows 7 on a solid-state disk, it is gone. You aren't getting it back.
Very helpful, isn't it?
Well, I guess it's to help these companies that send their computers abroad and stuff whenever they get decommissioned. But
security-wise, it's a good thing. But as forensic-wise, it's not the best of things. But having said that, the majority of evidence that you really find on people's computers, that quite often it's saved in files that are perfectly accessible because people don't necessarily know they're about to get caught doing something. Bear in mind there's things like page files and all that kind of thing. There's just because something's wiped from a specific location doesn't mean it isn't anywhere else.
No, well, absolutely not. And I've got two thoughts on this. I mean, the first one I've already said, that once it's gone, it's gone. We're going to struggle to pull things back from unallocated clusters. But the second thing is that if you're running a keyword search or something on a drive where something like this has happened, you're just going to zip through your case, aren't you? Because you're not going to get the hundreds of thousands of hits which are pulled back from unallocated space, which don't mean anything.
Yeah, it would be a bit of a relief to a number of investigators, I suppose, to not have to worry about finding some weird, obscure little reference to something in unallocated clusters and then have to find out roughly how that got there or try and explain it in some way because it's just not there.
Yeah. And it also makes things a bit easier to explain to juries and in witness statements and reports and stuff like that as well, I think. You don't have to go into a great deal of depth about what is unallocated clusters, how do things get there, and this, that, and the other. So I think there's good points, there's bad points. Obviously, it means we're going to find less evidence in the long run, but like you said, a good investigator will find the evidence on a computer
Well, this is assuming that solid-state drives really become a hugely mainstream thing. They may well do that. I see them being a lot more popular in laptops than in desktops and things like that.
Absolutely, so, yeah.
It's a question of what sort of percentage of computers we might even be looking at here. It could be a very small number, really.
Yeah. Oh, well, obviously it's going to depend entirely upon adoption rates and stuff like that as well, but you never know. I mean, the computers in a couple of years' time, they may say, right, forget about using motorized mechanical drives. Let's just all use the solid-state stuff instead. And if they do, then it becomes an issue. If not, then it's less of an issue, isn't it? So, But anyway, yeah. There's a couple of stories these last couple of weeks about file sharing, which I thought would be quite interesting to cover. The first one is that a lot of people have probably heard about the three strikes laws, which some countries are trying to bring in. And unfortunately, in this country, it doesn't look like it's going to be any different. Lord Mandelson, the wonderful, nice person he is, has decided, or has taken it upon himself to proclaim that people should be given three opportunities before being completely cut off from their internet connection. Three opportunities that, if they file share, if they do it once, they get a warning, do it twice, they get another warning, do it a third time, they get cut off entirely. Now, I think there's so many issues with this. I think it's ridiculous because this, how can there be proper due process in this? How can you say stuff like, well, yeah, this person is guilty of it and just cut them off? Because surely somebody must be innocent until they've been proven to be guilty.
I guess it depends on what you classify as proof, doesn't it, really?
Well, yeah, but there's also, each person should also have the opportunity to face his accusers. There's something else which happened a few months ago, was that they're saying that people should not be allowed to testify from behind a screen anymore. So there'll be no more faceless witnesses. And I think that was done so that the accused could look at his accuser in the face and, see who it is who's accusing them. Now, if some corporation just cuts you off the internet because the government told them to, who's your accuser? What's your appeal process?
Mm-hmm. I don't know that they would have to have measures in place for this, of course, that, mind you, having said that, you just never know.
No.
But I would hope that if this is going to be brought in, it's going to be brought in with some amount of sensibility and some amount of consideration as to the ins and outs of it all, because it could cause problems for people. But bear in mind that essentially what you're signing up to with an internet service provider is a service, and they will have terms of use, and if you go outside of those terms of use, then you're not necessarily entitled to that service.
Yes, I know, but we've seen how organizations like the RIAA and the MPAA, who are, we always talk about because they're our favorite people in the world, we always talk about screw-ups that they make.
Yeah.
And they do, because they base everything on on their IP addresses, and they've ended up suing dead people. They've ended up suing a printer. They've ended up suing people who don't even own a computer, have never had an internet connection. So these things are just unreliable.
Yeah. But I guess you got to say that. While these are the cases that sort of stand out, it's not going to be the majority of cases. This is going to be a small percentage of it. So I can understand a service provider for anything, really. If someone's outside of the bounds of what they're supposed to be using a service for, saying, we don't really want to supply you with the service anymore. It's not a case of someone signs up or someone downloads something illegally, therefore they're considered a criminal. It's just the fact that they have to find another service provider. But it depends on what sort of level they go to with this as to whether you're then blacklisted or something.
No, well, that's the impression that you get, though, isn't it? Is that the people will get cut off and they will get blacklisted and will not be able to have the internet. Because otherwise they're just going to be persistent, aren't they?
Yeah, which kind of goes against another thing that the government have said, where they're trying to get internet access in every home in the country. But, there you go.
I don't understand why the government spends money policing copyright when it's not really their issue.
It's not anything to do with them.
No, all we're doing is that we're... Oh, this is quite an annoying topic for me. I'm not saying that I advocate downloading of copyrighted material by any stretch of the imagination, but I just think the way this is being policed is completely wrong. It's just not right. And that there's validation for this as well. Well, not really validation, but another article which came out just a couple of days ago shows that a recent study shows that illegal downloaders are the people who spend the most money on music.
Yeah.
The illegal people who download music illegally spent on average £77 a year on music, which is £33 more than those who claim they never download music dishonestly. So, it's just...
Well, it is based on a few things, this report, such as the fact that you're taking everyone at their word as to whether they've downloaded anything illegally.
Granted.
But yeah, it is an interesting... turn up for things, and it may make one or two people think a bit more about what to say when they're so quick to jump on the bandwagon of everyone who downloads music is killing the music industry, because it might not necessarily be true.
No. I think that when you see such contention within these industries themselves, I mean, artists crying out against organizations saying, you know, you're treating our fans unfairly and stuff like that, and then some who are backing them. Mm. And I wish I could remember who it was now, but somebody was being sued by the RIAA a few months ago, and the artist, the band that the guy was downloading their songs, actually paid for the guy's defense to defend himself against the RIAA, and so they caved. They said, "All right, we're not going to bother anymore."
Interesting.
So it's just it's a weird topic. This, I think, if people want the music industry and the movie industry to change, then change your habits. You know, don't buy the music, don't download it illegally, just don't obtain it. They won't make any money, and it will force them to change their practices and their habits. So, I just think, I personally think they're all evil and should burn in hell. But that's just my opinion.
I think that they should really realise that the exposure they get from a lot of what they deem to be and what is in fact illegal activity in whatever kind it is, whether it's streaming of movies online or downloading music through file sharing software or whatever it might be, exposure isn't always a bad thing. And it can get the material that's produced by these people to places where it wouldn't have otherwise gone. And so they can, in fact, sometimes benefit from these things. And so saying that everything along the lines of illegal activity, copyright infringement is destroying the industry is perhaps going a bit too far. But on the other hand, this study, I'm not quite so sure I believe the figures, really, just because You're saying it's saying that out of 1,000 16 to 50 year olds with internet access, 1 in 10 people admitted to downloading music illegally. Now, I'm pretty sure it's a lot more than that.
I don't think it's a lot more than that. I think it's probably a little more than that. When you look at people, if you think about, you know, the people who are in their 40s and everything, they probably don't care enough to go out and download music. But I don't know. Who knows? That's unfortunately something I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of, because no one will tell the truth in these surveys, will they?
No. Or in fact, in anything for the other side of the argument, really. So,
yeah.
I think some of these things can be good to get word out about artists, about their music, or about movies, and increase the popularity, which, for all we know, could end up making money for these people. On the other hand, it could end up costing them money. Who knows?
Yeah. All right. Our favourite state, Simon, Texas. Funnily enough, this is not a story about PI laws. I think I can hear Luby cheering now. Hang on. Yeah, I can hear him, yeah. Right. A law was set up in Texas in the 1970s that allows parents to show harmful materials to their children. And it's come under fire by after a prosecutor said he couldn't file charges against a man who was accused of forcing his 8- and 9-year-old daughters to watch hardcore online pornography. Now, that's, to me, it is a bit strange that this law was ever put in place, because you've got people like this poor woman whose name temporarily evades me, who was that teacher in the States who had all those pop-ups and...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wasn't it? I can't remember her name for the life of me. That's terrible. But, you know, if that happened in Texas, then, you know, she walks away without, you know, probably with a slap on the wrists. But, I mean, you can understand that, like, this law, basically, it was put into place in order for parents and teachers to be able to show children videos about, you know, sex education and stuff like that, essentially, I guess. And this law that they brought in for that purpose, because of the way it's written and interpreted, basically means that anybody can invite children into their home and, any parents can show their children any kind of harmful material they want and get away with it.
It's ridiculous, really. It's absolutely crazy. Because you just don't know what effect some of the things that kids could end up seeing could have on their development, on them in later life. And for this to actually be legal somewhere, I just think it's a bit of a joke.
Yeah. Well, I think that when, you know, back in the 70s when this law was made, it wasn't such a big issue as it is now, is it, with showing illegal material to minors and
no,
you know, the widespread, the easy availability of downloading the stuff online and things like that. So it probably wasn't as big of a deal, but it certainly had unforeseen circumstances that the mother in this family wants her now ex-husband to be jailed. But it's, in her own words, when she was told that nothing could be done, she said, "Are you kidding me? There's no way this can't be right." And it's just, you can understand that, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I can't imagine parents ever wanting to allow their children to ever see this kind of material. And I don't know what else to say about it. It's just odd, and it needs to be dealt with. I don't know if it was as much of an issue getting on for, 30 to 40 years ago, but it certainly is today, and something needs to be done about it, really.
No. But regardless of whatever they do to change this law now, this guy still walks free because it's not going to be backdated, is it? So
no.
It can't be. So it's just... It's bizarre. I mean, morally, he must know that he's done something wrong. And everyone else knows that he's done something wrong. Now, the benefit of this is that, you know, the guy's name is out there now, and people can... He'll struggle to be sociable in any way, shape, or form now. I should imagine his life will become somewhat of a living hell, and probably prison would have been a better alternative. But it just boggles the mind. How can there be a law like... How can one state do this and screw up so many things? I just don't have any idea.
No.
But anyway, write to your congressman if you're in Texas and try and get the law changed. Okay. Moving on. Over here in the UK right now, there's a big, big debate going on because the government has just launched essentially a new law that requires anybody who is in constant contact with children that are not their own to obtain a criminal background check from the police. Now, these criminal background checks cost about £65. That's around about $100 per person. And can
which isn't subsidised, by the way.
No, which isn't subsidised at all. And can take a good few months to get back. So now think about who this applies to. This is going to shock some people, I think, right? This is going to apply, obviously, to teachers. This is going to apply to day carers. Then you've got to think about who else is this going to apply to. Bus drivers, train conductors, general contractors who come into your home who could be in a position where they're left alone, left in the same room as a child for a moment. It's just, what are they doing? It just drives me utterly mental. My personal opinion is wrong. It shouldn't happen. But what's the alternative to protecting these children? I mean...
I can see the reasoning behind it. But I think perhaps it's a little bit over the top when you look into some of the situations that we've had. One at the time this law came about involved two single parent police officers who, they organised their shifts so while one was at work, the other one would look after their child and vice versa.
Yeah.
So they would look after each other's children, and they were then somehow reported by someone and informed that they were in fact doing that illegally and that they needed to both go through this criminal record check. And you think that's just completely ludicrous for babysitting, and especially considering these two people were police officers. It's a bit
how
of a
do they go through more vetting?
I don't know.
Surely if they're police officers, they must already have been vetted.
You'd have thought so, but it really, really puzzled me, and I'm just thinking this can't be true, but in actual fact, that's according to the law, that was in fact true. And it's insane. But
so, yeah.
There's a point to which you can say it's understandable, it makes sense, and it's fair, but you take it beyond that point and it becomes a bit ludicrous.
Yeah. I mean, we're even down to the point where if you do the school run in the morning and you pick up other children on your way to dropping your children off at school, you have to have the CRB. You have to have a criminal background check. And just stupid little things like that. Who's going to... I'll just say, you know what, stuff it. It's not worth it. I'm not paying the money to do that. It's not worth my time. If somebody wants me to do it, they can damn well contribute to it, because I'm not doing that anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think that it puts more pressure on people. And how this managed to squeeze in and become law, I don't have a clue. It's demented. Some slightly funnier news now. For all you people who have got your iPhones, first of all, why? Second of all, if you have unlocked it...
You want an iPhone, don't deny it.
I don't want an iPhone. I wanted an iPhone once upon a time. Now, I love Android. I don't think I could ever go back from using Android.
I could swear just the other day you were talking about buying a second-hand iPhone.
Yeah, for like messing around with and testing and stuff, not for everyday use.
Okay, I'll let you off.
Honestly. But anyway, yes, getting back to the story, as I was trying to tell, if you've jailbroken your iPhone, you may be in for a nasty surprise. In the Netherlands, a bunch of people yesterday got an interesting message that said, "Your iPhone has been hacked because it's really insecure. Please visit doyop.com/ihacked and secure your phone right now." And that message popped up right in the middle of people's screens. And he said, essentially, for $4.95, I'll give you instructions on how to secure your iPhones and remove the message from appearing at startup. Now, the way he was able to do this is that whenever you jailbreak an iPhone, typically you're going to have an SSH daemon on there that allows you to connect to the phone in order to exploit it and unlock it and everything else. And what he's done is that he's run a port scan over a bunch of IP addresses, found which iPhones have got SSH enabled. He was able to go in because all iPhones have got the same root password. And using that default root password, he's able to go in and make modifications to these phones. Now, he claims that... he says, "If you don't pay, it's fine by me. But remember, the way I got access to your iPhone can be used by thousands of others, and they can send text messages to your number, from your number, like I did. Use it to call or record your calls, and actually whatever they want, even using it for their hacking activities." So, I'm not saying that, he's not incorrect in this, but say, for example, that's true, and you can basically manipulate these iPhones for whatever purpose he wants, that's pretty scary.
It is, yeah.
I mean, a couple of months ago, this is what I think is quite amusing. See, a couple of months ago, Steve Jobs came out and he said, people who hack their iPhones are helping terrorism and all this kinds of stuff. And see, and you even snigger just then and you laugh. But
then in light of things like this,
I tell you what,
maybe we shouldn't.
You could set up a botnet on these iPhones pretty damn easily, couldn't you? If you got straight full access to these. Now,
they're certainly a popular phone as well, yeah. So it could be quite effective.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
I wonder if the BBC are looking into that.
Oh, stop it. but it's just, it's crazy. But there are ways to overcome this. If you have a jailbroken iPhone, you change the root password, which is quite simple to do. You'd be able to find instructions to do it online. In fact, most of the sites which offer you the unlocking services will give you directions on how to do that. Change the root password, and you shouldn't have a problem from that point forward, really. But it just goes to show you, doesn't it, that people will do things and they won't think anything of it. I wouldn't think. I mean, I have to admit, I rooted my G1 a few weeks ago. I've restored it back to normal now, but it was so easy to do. And the benefits of it are quite extensive. If you think of the people who want to use their iPhone for tethering, for example, and, you know, you go in, set it up, and without knowing about it, you've just given full access to anybody to walk into your iPhone and do whatever they please.
Yeah.
Especially when you consider that these phones aren't behind, you know, like our computers are not behind a router or a firewall or anything like that. They are out in the wild, aren't they?
They are indeed.
So, yeah. If anybody
got one of those things, people to be maybe educated on and be made aware of is the fact that yes, you have certain security things in place, perhaps when you're using your computer at home, but a number of these just aren't there for your mobile devices, which are being used more and more as computers,
yeah,
for storing all sorts of things.
Well, if you got full access to someone's phone, you could ruin their life, couldn't you? Really,
you could do. Yeah,
you could get all their contacts and their emails. You know, you could get their address. You could get their address and the their Wi-Fi. WPA or WEP code or whatever, and just go and sit outside the house and download child porn to your heart's extent, to your heart's content even, and get them into a lot of trouble.
Yeah, you know, there's all sorts of things you could do. I mean, if this person that you managed to hack into has a means of storing credit card numbers or passwords or anything like that in one of these wallet softwares, you could essentially control someone's life, really.
Yeah. So it's something to be wary of. If you do that, then please change the password. But considering it's against the EULA and potentially, as Apple claims, against the law to do so, you might not want to go rooting your not rooting on the iPhone. What is it again?
Jailbreaking
your iPhone anyway, because it's a you get asked if you've done that in court, you might look a bit stupid. But anyway, moving on, I've been looking forward to this for quite some time, actually. We have an interview with Johnny Long now. That's right, the Johnny Long. And I'm so, so pleased that he gave us the opportunity to have him on the podcast. We did an interview with him a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, and here it is. I hope you enjoy it. Okay, this week we're joined by none other than the legendary Johnny Long. Nice of you to join us this week, Johnny.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm really glad I could hang out with you for a little while.
Cool stuff. All right, well, for those of our listeners who haven't heard of you or may have heard of you but don't really know what you do, would you like to just introduce yourself a little bit and explain your background, maybe?
Sure. Well, I spent most of my career in technology. You know, I did the typical system administration jobs and things like that. But my heart was really into security and hacking and figuring out how to break stuff. I was never really good at putting it together, and so it was interesting that I got into the field through a big company, CSC. They gave me a start when I was pretty young, and I was able to do security work for them, spent quite a few years as a professional hacker breaking into government facilities and corporate facilities, and basically made my living out of deception and getting past security systems and all that fun stuff. It was just an absolutely fabulous, fabulous ride along the way. I wrote a few books and did a few presentations, and next thing you know, it turns out I'm a household name. So that's the career part in summary. And what I'm doing now is my family and I live in Uganda in East Africa, and that story's a little bit more complex, but let's just say I find myself almost on a completely different planet, it seems, sometimes.
I can only imagine. So what prompted you to do that then? Why did you feel the need to up your family and move to this virtually, you know, the virtual unknown? And
well, I think I can blame most of it on my wife. It's definitely her fault. she went on a trip in 2006 with our church to Uganda. It had always been her dream to go to Africa, and you know, this was something that I felt pretty strongly that she had to do. It was something she thought about since she was a little kid, and you know, I watched over the house while she was gone and the kids, and you know, when she came back, I was glad to have her back. But something had changed. I mean, she saw things in Uganda that we had never seen before, you know, just ridiculous poverty and that stuff I expected, but I didn't expect her to come back with pictures of smiling kids and you know, joy, you know, these kids that were absolutely thrilled to see her and to just hang out with her, and they had absolutely nothing. And that took me by surprise. In 2006, I was at the top of my game. I mean, I had pretty much accomplished everything there was to accomplish in my industry, you know, in terms of recognition and respect of my peers and, you know, doing things in the community and all that. But at the same time, I had felt pretty unfulfilled about it all. You know, I felt like I had hit the glass ceiling and there wasn't much else to do. And a couple different factors came together, and I decided that, you know, the next time she went to Uganda, I would go with her. And that's what I did. We, in 2007, took our first trip together, and the organization that we worked with found out that I was a computer guy. They didn't know too much more beyond that, but it turned out they had some computers that were key to their organization that needed some help. And what they did is they'd use these computers to enter profiles to basically create Word documents for children that were in trouble. You know, kids that had lost their parents to AIDS or, you know, malaria or, you know, any number of killers over here. And these documents were sent off to try to find sponsors, people to help take care of their medical needs and education and all that. And their computers were such an absolute mess that they weren't getting much done. They were overrun with viruses. They weren't networked together, so each machine had its own function. And basically, I spent 2 weeks, you know, myself and, you know, a couple other guys that had a technical background on that team, and we fixed up their office. But the short version of the story is that that little bit of work actually changed people's lives. You know, this was, you know, because of the computers being repaired, they were taking profiles again, and they were finding sponsors, and they were feeding kids. And that was something that I had never done before. You know, the result of my work was something that I hardly ever saw. You know, I would come into a company and break their security and leave behind a report, and somebody else would fix it. You know, I never really saw an impact like this. And it was extremely powerful, you know, to do something that not only changes someone's life, but to do life-saving work and to see a little bit of effort go a really long way. And 6 months after that trip, I found myself still thinking about Africa and riding the buzz of that work and thinking, man, what else can I do? And that's where the idea for Hackers for Charity came from. And the concept was pretty simple. It was, well, if I can do all of this, you know, as an individual, imagine how much, you know, the community could do if we pulled together, if we took the skills that we have in the hacker community and worked together for some positive change, what would that look like? And that was the experiment. And that's what led us here. It just became such a passion, and it opened up a new level of accomplishment in my life, things that made a real difference. And, you know, a lot of things changed in my life for me spiritually. You know, I felt like I was, you know, God was leading me to make a decision to take, you know, my life to the next level. And that's what we're doing. That's why we're here.
Fantastic. Now, ask you just a personal question. How do your kids feel about all this?
Well, that was something I was really concerned about. You know, I didn't want to, I didn't want to have a situation where, you know, I just was dragging my kids kicking and screaming. So we did make a 3-week trip and, to sort of screen things and, you know, brought the whole family for 3 weeks to see how the kids took to it. And, you know, I really saw my kids come alive. You know, they, my boys are addicted to video games, and in the 3-week time stretch, you know, we found them outside playing with sticks and rocks and chasing chickens. And, you know, it was a new side of the kids that was really intoxicating. It was great. And that was one of the steps that brought us closer to relocating. And so we were in this together. You know, it was definitely a family decision. We had some misgivings, but the bottom line was we had gotten to the point where we couldn't do any more from, you know, the U.S. You know, doing remote work only would go so far. And, you know, we were all together in that decision.
Very cool. So how long of a process was it from the time you decided that you were going to move from the U.S. to Uganda? I assume like visas and everything took quite a while to get a hold of.
It was quick. You know, it was only about 6 months. The 6 months though were really insane. when I left CSC to pursue this, I didn't. You know, I had about 12 years under my belt at the company, and you know, never imagined that I'd work anywhere else. I really had a dream job. You know, CSC was great to me, and they, you know, they had gotten me to the point where I could, you know, make my own decisions and call my own shots and, you know, decide what areas I would do research in. And, you know, I pretty much had a blank check in terms of the things that I could do, and we had a great relationship. But I left that, and in the process of doing that, I left for a small startup that, you know, offered me the world. And I kind of made a fatal error in combining friendship and business, and took the word of an old friend that, you know, hey, yeah, we'll look after you when you're in Africa and you can work remotely. And you know, I made some bad decisions and had a pretty poor work ethic. And in 3 months, I had left that company as well. So all paths were leading to Uganda. You know, I found myself without a job. You know, and a little bit at a time found that this was definitely the direction that we were supposed to be going.
Okay, now when you got to Uganda, one of the quite well publicized stories about your trip so far is the whole PayPal issue. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we're living off of support. I mean, I don't draw a salary from HFC. What we do is we told people what we were doing, and we set up a little PayPal repository that said, you know, if you want to help us with what we're doing, you know, you want to donate a few bucks or whatever, here's, you know, click this button, and all of our finances, not just the organization's finances, but our personal finances were tied up in PayPal. Well, at some point, I had to switch from a personal account to a business account as we started going through the process of registering as a tax exempt organization. And when I did that, I made a mistake and checked the box that said the business that we have is a 501c3, it's tax exempt. And at the time we weren't. And I got to a screen that said, hey, enter the details of your organization's tax status, and I realized I had checked the wrong button because we didn't have that status yet, and there was no going back. You know, there was no undo button, and I found myself in the mire of, you know, remote support and emails, and there was I couldn't even get a person on the phone to say, you know, look, I've made a mistake. And after a few days, PayPal locked our account, waiting for answers to the questions that I couldn't give them. And here I am, I'm trying to find an internet connection to Skype home because, you know, I can't make phone calls because they're ridiculously expensive. And I'm spending, you know, half an hour at a time on hold trying to call PayPal to get them to unlock our account.
Wow.
And this was a really bad deal. I mean, I clicked the wrong button. It was completely my fault that this thing happened. But the bottom line was we were without money, you know, as a result of this. You know, PayPal had all our money. So I basically got on my website and put a blog out there and got on Twitter and made a sensational headline out of it that said, you know, PayPal shuts down hackers for charity. You know, and it was true. It was a little sensational, but it was true. And the community just exploded with this thing. Within about 6 hours, not only did I have, a contact at PayPal who had unlocked our account and resolved the issue, I had the executive office of PayPal pleading for me to get my people to stop. You know, make them stop, whatever you can do. You know, and I'm hearing stories about their phone switches blowing up and fax servers melting down and, you know, email servers falling over. And I was like, man, this is like War Games, you know, or the movie Hackers or something. It was really, really intense. And that was a big deal to me because it was powerful, but it was something positive as well. You know, this wasn't a bunch of hackers taking down a company. This was a bunch of people saying, you know, we believe in what you're doing and we'll lend a little bit of elbow grease to help you do it. And I thought that was very cool. And we're still PayPal clients. I mean, we still use PayPal. We don't have any, ill feelings towards them, but man, that was definitely the power of community.
It must be a fantastic feeling when a bunch of people, I mean, so many people in this instance all get together to pull behind you and, you know, really, really, you can tell they really believe in what you're doing. What a feeling that must be.
Yeah, and it came at just the right time. I mean, I was really, you know, we were pretty early on in our trip and, you know, we were starting to feel a little bit overwhelmed with life. You know, life here is not what it is in, you know, in a developed country. Life is very difficult. And yeah. We were starting to get a little bit down about it. And then the money thing happened, and we were just really at our wit's end, just even as a family, let alone as an organization. At that point, we weren't doing HFC stuff. We were just trying to survive, you know, and get our bearings before we got to work. And, man, that thing happened at just the right time. And, in fact, that was the reason I decided to go to DEF CON this year was, you know, the fact that the community was behind us and people were excited about what we were doing. And that's what motivated me to fly all the way from here to Vegas to, you know, to hang out with the community.
Fantastic. So when all that stuff started happening, was there a point where you felt like maybe I'm not doing it right? Maybe I should just stop and go home.
Yeah. Well, I have those thoughts, you know, several times a week. I mean, you know, things are tenuous, you know, but at the same time, for every time I think that, you know, there's 10 times that I think, man, I wouldn't be doing anything else. You know, Africa is a continent of extremes, you know, and living with that day to day, you know, life is real and life is in your face. And, you know, emotions run really hot, you know, just, you know, it's as hot as the sun on the equator here. It's rough. And yeah. So it's not uncommon to have those sharp ups and downs. It's just, it really is almost a different planet than what most people that have grown up in a developed country can understand.
Yeah. All right. I can completely understand that. I wish, obviously I've not been there, so I can't say that I understand it to the same degree, but I can only imagine the difficulties that people must have down there. Now, What?
It's nice though. On the other hand, there's a certain freedom, you know, about it as well. You know, we've had an interesting opportunity as a family to get out of the rat race, you know, and to you know, just sort of hit the pause button on all the things that we used to think were really important to us. And that's a rare gift when you get to take some distance from your life and sort of see what's important. That's a huge thing.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Okay, well, let's talk about Hackers for Charity in a bit more detail now then.
All right.
What exactly are you doing there? What's the big thing or the big things that you're trying to do? What are the changes that you're trying to bring into people's lives out there?
Well, one of the biggest reasons that we're here is to provide an education. There's so many charities around us, and you know, just all over the continent and all over the world. And there's certainly nothing wrong with charity. There's nothing wrong with stepping in when people, you know, need something and helping them with those immediate needs. But the answer to poverty, if there's such a thing as a cure, is empowerment. It's education. It's the old adage of, you know, teaching a man how to fish and not just giving him the fish. So
yeah,
we're really big into that. And we're computer people. You know, we know technology. And so our little niche is to provide an education, a computer education, to anybody that's willing to accept it. You know, we try to make we put computer labs in existing classrooms to help students learn computer skills. Some of the students, you know, most of the students aren't destined to work in an office. You know, they're not going to go into the big cities. We're in the villages here. A lot of them are going to take these very basic skills and use those skills for money. You know, some of them will stand up a little word processing business or a little shop where they'll print documents or type documents, or just, you know, what is menial work to us can literally feed, you know, several families. So a lot of them take those skills just at face value, and they'll regurgitate them, you know, and have a lifetime of just doing what we think is menial work, but it literally changes them. You know, it gets them out of the loop of relying on someone else. So that's the classroom initiative. We're trying to build as many classrooms as we can. We're also focusing on one of the big efforts that we're looking at is creating community centers so that multiple schools can come in and sort of timeshare one center, and that people in the community can come in and sit down and use a computer. The fact is, computer training is available here, but most people can't afford it. A typical training course will cost approximately a 3 months of salary. So
wow.
To sit down and get a basic computer course, you have to save up 3 months of your salary to be able to do that. And that's just absolutely ludicrous. We're trying to change that. And in our community centers, we hope to make it incredibly affordable, if not free, for people to come in and get skills that they can use to get jobs. And then
Fantastic.
The other thing that we're doing is we also have a food program that we're running in Kenya, and that's sort of the charitable arm of what we do. That's literally putting, you know, food on the table for people that just have nothing. You know, it sort of partners with our classroom initiative. We have a classroom that we've built in Kenya as well for training. But this is immediate need stuff. Proceeds from some of my books are going into that program, and that's just meeting the needs of people directly. And the third thing that we do is we try to have an outlet for charities that need tech support. You know, a lot of organizations are doing really good work, but they don't have the money to afford the skills that, you know, our community has. So we try to make those skills available to charities that need them in exchange for job experience for our volunteers. So we help people build a resume and get some credentials so that they can get a better job. The volunteers can get a better job, but at the same time, they're helping out charities that are out doing good work that haven't had the time or the resources to get, you know, good tech work done.
All right. Fantastic. Now, you mentioned Kenya, and obviously you're based primarily in Uganda, but
right.
you're doing work in several different countries, aren't you?
Yeah, and that's one of the things I don't want to the focus of the organization has been on sort of the work that I'm doing, you know, as the lead cheerleader and, you know, founder and all that stuff. But really, it's just about getting people to do something good, you know, to use the skills that they have to help others. And so we don't want it to be a centralized effort that's just all about Africa. You know, I'd love to see HFC be a connector. You know, if you're in the UK, if you're in Wales, and you notice that there's a charity that's down the corner, and you know, maybe it's a shelter for homeless kids, and they have a beat up computer, and all the kids are crowded around it. I'd want, you know, somebody to come to our boards and say, "Hey, is there anybody else in Wales that might have some extra computers? I think, you know, I'd like to give some to this place." Or, you know, "Hey, this website's doing, you know, this charity's doing great work. They don't even have a website. You know, I don't know web stuff. Anybody know web stuff?" And, you know, I'd like to see those sorts of things spring up all over the place, because it's, like I said, it's not about Africa. You know, it's about helping people that are in need. And it just, you know, Africa just happens to be a place where that goes, a little bit of effort goes a really long way. So it's we can have a bigger impact here than we could in a developed country. But this is just for anybody that, you know, wants to do some good and have some extra cycles.
I think that you're exactly right. A lot of people will think, whenever you mention, you know, charitable work or charitable giving, they'll immediately think, well, right, we'll either throw money at it, or, you know, they're going to want me to go out and dig wells or something like that. But that's not necessarily true, is it? I mean, like you said, people can get involved at a community level, and they can make a significant difference in the places where they live, even.
Absolutely. I mean, we've all got, you know, we've all got gifts that we've been given in terms of skills and resources. And, you know, if everybody was out there digging wells and no one was doing anything else, you know, we'd be missing a lot of things. It's certainly nothing wrong with, you know, digging wells, but it's just about using what you have. And, you know, this community is, you know, I'm a product of this community. You know, the skills that I learned to get me a great job and to be able to do the things that I did, I learned from this community. And one of the things that I'd like to see is, I'd like to see this make a big difference in the perception of our community. You know, we've, as hackers and even as security people, we've gotten a bad rap because of, you know, a few people, the minority of people that are criminals in our community. I'd love to see this change that. I'd love to see people, you know, start talking about it and saying, "Hey, you know, I heard about this crazy, you know, charity thing with that, you know, hackers are out there building, you know, classrooms for poor kids." And, you know, because our community is not about the criminal element. You know, it's every society and every community has them, but unfortunately we're defined by them. I'd love to see that change.
Fantastic. No, I very, very, I agree with absolutely everything you said. Now, I don't know if you got any significant stories you can share with us about some of the work which you've done in the area where you are at the moment, where you've done something and you perhaps have changed somebody's life for the better. Anything spring to mind specifically?
Well, we've one of the things with the classrooms is that the return on the investment is a pretty far ways down the road. You know, the classrooms are a definite necessity, and, you know, but as anyone that's ever been in education can tell you, you're lucky if 10 years down the road you have one student come back and say, "You know what, you changed my life." But we did have the opportunity to work with a few individuals in particular. One young man that I met a few months ago, and his name was Fred. He was working, at the time he didn't have a job, but what he would do is he would fix people's laptops. you know, he took a course on hardware repair, and he would fix people's laptops. And the reason that he would do it is so that he could get them working and that he could have time on the laptop learning about computers, you know. And this guy was a hacker. You know, he had that certain something. He would sit up at all hours of the night. He would forget what time it was. You know, his friends would tell him that he needed to eat and, you know, he needed to get up. He was just so passionate about learning that he would do everything he could to get some computer time. And so I did a quick video segment and played it at DEF CON and said, you know what, I would love to buy this guy a laptop and encourage him and you know, see what happens. And so I just wanted to get a couple $100 raised. And, you know, the response was so overwhelming that we were able to buy him, you know, a laptop and a computer monitor and a keyboard and, you know, just all this stuff. And he was so absolutely overwhelmed. It was just an amazing thing. He was absolutely speechless. Well, the story gets even more interesting because that night I drove him home with all his gear. You know, I'm on a cloud here. You know, this is a great feeling. I'm like, you know, I feel like Santa Claus or something. And drive up to this guy's house, and we drop him off, and, you know, his family is there, and he introduces me to his family. And it turns out he doesn't exactly have a house. His family stays in the back room of a church, and they sort of watch over the church and would clean it up, and they could stay in this little room. And I thought, huh, well, that's interesting. Well, the next day, I came back to Fred's house, and I noticed his laptop wasn't there. I said, well, where's the laptop? And he says, oh, it's down the road. I'm charging it. I, what do you mean you're charging it? He says, well, we don't have power. And I thought, that is so typical, right? You know, the clumsy Westerner comes in and drops all these gifts and, you know, and prances away feeling all good about what he's done. And the bottom line was, I didn't even stop to ask the question, do you even have power? You know, I didn't ask him what his needs were. And that the story continues because, you know, that really struck me. And I talked to my wife and my family about it. And, you know, where we're staying, we have a guest house out back. And I said, what would you guys think if we just, you know, asked Fred to stay here in our guest house and be an employee of HFC? You know, to find out what a good salary would be and have him stay in our guest house and be an HFC employee to help me on the ground. And they thought it was a great idea. So Fred has been, you know, my constant companion here in Uganda. You know, and he's an amazing worker. He has just a thirst for knowledge. And his family is absolutely thrilled because now not only does he have a computer and he's getting, you know, these skills, but he's got a job and he's getting an education. And so that's been really cool. Yeah. He's been a great guy. And it's funny, the first paycheck, you know, everything's cash, but, you know, I gave him money and, you know, every month we give him a salary. And I was talking to him in the car and he went 2 days after I paid him, he went back home and gave his money for the entire month to pay his sister's tuition in school. And basically for 1 month of his, for basically 2 weeks of his salary, he paid for his sister to go through school for an entire semester.
Fantastic.
So it goes to show you how different, you know, they are as a culture. You know, the people here are just, you know, it's a different mentality where they're looking out for each other and they're willing to give each other a hand up and look out for their family. And so the Fred story continues. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to it.
Fantastic. But I think that personally, that's my perspective, is that you go out there, you go out there to teach them about, you know, computing and giving them education, everything else, but your return on investment as a human being, you must learn so much more than you could ever hope to teach them.
Yeah, it's so true. I think what I'm learning is so much more valuable than what he's learning.
Oh, unbelievable. All right. Well, if people want to get involved with Hackers for Charity, there's several different ways they can do that. Would you want to just run us through them?
Sure. Well, the biggest thing is spreading the word. I mean, talking to people about what we're doing. This is a work in progress. I mean, even our website is constantly changing to try to figure out how to best present options for people that want to get involved. So, you know, talk to people about what we're doing. You know, if in your daily life, if you run into charities that look like they might need help, get on our boards and start talking about it. That's one of the biggest things. Money is a big one. We have t-shirts that we sell with, you know, our logo on it. That's one of our fundraisers. We have a subscription service called Informer that gives subscribers access to content from the InfoSec world in advance. So, for example, Roloff Temming at Multigo, or at Paterva, released Multigo early. He had a license for Multigo that was a super license they released on Informer. Our subscribers got access to it. No one else did. Backtrack released their latest release through Informer a month before the rest of the internet got it. And of course, Backtrack is absolutely huge. So Informer is one of our biggest sources of revenue right now. It's funding most of our programs. And that's about $54 a year. So it's a very small, you know, very small thing, but the idea is to get lots of subscribers and keep the price low and offer something valuable. Corporations can donate an entire classroom. You know, we have options to entirely brand a classroom, so a company can come in and say, hey, you know what, we'd like to put 10 computers in Uganda. We take the money and we purchase the equipment locally to stimulate the local economy. And put those into classrooms. You can buy books. All the proceeds from my latest book, No Tech Hacking, go back into the program. You know, there's an awful lot to do to get plugged in. But like I said, the biggest thing is to just get the word out there about what we're doing.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with us today. Really, really do appreciate that. And I'm hoping that this opens some people's eyes and really makes them think about just even going out of their front door and finding someone to help. Like you say, I mean, this, the community, the computer forensic, you know, security hacking community, that it's a major, major untapped resource. And I think that what you're doing out there sets such an example for us all. Just thank you very much.
Well, I'm proud to do it, and you know, just to everyone that's listening, I just want to thank you all for, you know, thinking about us and the encouragement that I've gotten. I mean, a lot of your listeners at some point have dropped me an email or, you know, stepped into a talk, and those are the sorts of things that keep me going. So, thank you very much, and hope to talk to you again.
And welcome back. Hope you enjoyed the interview there with Johnny Long. And it's well worth going to visit his website and doing what you can to contribute to his cause. Because as you can tell from the interview, it's something that he's passionate about. Something which I think deserves a great deal of attention and a great deal of support as well.
Yeah, it's always worth pointing out the fact that when you donate to Hackers for Charity, he's quite willing to give things back as well, and you can sign up for all sorts of things as you contribute, and you can get previews of software, you can get pre-release versions of things. It's quite possible you can get things you wouldn't otherwise get if you contribute. So it's worth bearing things like that in mind, I think.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, before we go any further, it was someone's birthday recently.
I've heard that as well.
Yeah, on Sunday, the 8th of November, Mark McKinnon turned the ripe old age of 52.
I'd imagine that verbal boxing match on Google Wave is going to suddenly start to possibly move up a notch again after a comment like that.
Possibly. But we just want to wish Mark a belated, extremely happy birthday, and thanks for all the fantastic work you do. Yeah, hope you have many, many more.
Yeah.
I didn't even say that sarcastically. I really actually mean it this time. Honest.
Yeah, no, I believe you.
Okay. All right. Well, it's nearly time to wrap up, but before we go, Simon, have you got a funny little story for us?
Yeah, I in fact did find three that are funny. I'm not actually going to bore people by going through all three of them, but two of them I'll just briefly mention. There was an Italian motorcyclist was clocked on a speed camera doing 383 miles per hour.
Good grief.
He doesn't seem to believe that's accurate, and I can understand why. So he's planning on challenging that.
Not surprised.
If he finds that, if someone does certify that that's correct, he's going to then see if he can claim a world record for it. another man in Poland was actually did a very strange thing and tried to hold up a bank in Poland with nothing for a weapon other than a stainless steel spoon.
Muppet.
Yeah, some would say he is a spoon, but the majority of people wouldn't have a clue what that's going on about.
That's a 90s throwback right there.
It is indeed. But anyway, yeah, apparently he broke some law and the police were after him. He was laughed out of the bank, but they're going to try and track him down and arrest him for waving a spoon around in a public place or something. But the story that's worth focusing on is that woman plays dog to scare burglar. Yeah, this is correct. A woman in Athens, Georgia, was stalled by the sound of someone trying to break into her home. This is according to the Athens Banner Herald. The man tried turning the doorknob, tried to get in. So she got down on all fours, began scratching at the door and acting like a large dog. there's no more information given on that, but there's been various bits of speculation rife on the internet, such as what she may have done to act like a dog. Use your own imaginations.
Oh, for goodness sake. No, don't use your own imaginations.
I wasn't thinking of anything unusual. I was just thinking of things along the lines of barking and some of the comments that have popped up online have been like, was this person a cat burglar?
Oh, no.
Yeah, see, it's this is why I suggested using your own imagination, because the reality is stupid. And someone asked if this woman had had her shots and was she wearing a name tag.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so one way to deter burglars. This guy ran off and was, I believe, evaded police and hasn't been captured. But she managed to avoid someone trying to get into her house by, barking like a dog, I suppose.
Well, let's hope he hasn't read this article then, because he might go back and just ignore the dog barking next time.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Although, if he tried it at a few places and got a few dog barks, he could pick the wrong one, couldn't he, really?
Very true. And end up with his hand bitten off or something.
Probably not worth the risk.
No, probably not. All right, well, thanks for that. And thank you very much for joining us for another episode of Forensic Forecast. We will return soon. Bye for now.
Bye.